In part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of chocolate, 40 kinds of coffee, and 200 kinds of tea. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sports shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. Today, our monthly discussion about the law. This is a program we do once a month on the last Friday of the month. And our topic this month, our topic today, is divorce. Our guest is attorney and mediator Sam Margulies. He's also the author of two books on divorce. The first was Getting Divorced Without Ruining Your Life. His latest is addressed to men who have been married a while and who have children. The title is A Man's Guide to a Civilized Divorce, How to Divorce with Grace, a Little Class, and a Lot of Common Sense. Here are a couple of excerpts from the introduction to this book. Although divorce can be painful for both men and women, men often have very different experiences than women and have different problems to solve. Men often lack a model for getting divorced without a useless war. Many people still believe that divorce is a war to be won or lost, an image that has particular resonance for men who are still encouraged to stand up and fight for their rights. Listeners, I invite your questions this afternoon for our guest, Sam Margulies. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, call toll-free. Use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. He has degrees in psychology, international relations, political science, and law. He's a pioneer in the field of mediation and has taught mediation for some 20 years. A Man's Guide to a Civilized Divorce is published by the Rodale Press. And again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Sam Margulies, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Sure. In the introduction to this new book on divorce, you say something that I think is very important. Almost all divorces are resolved with a negotiated settlement, and the manner in which settlement is pursued shapes the rest of your life. Talk with us about that. How does the pursuit of a settlement shape the lives of the members of a family?
Well, if you take the universe of divorce, about maybe 1% actually go to trial. 99% are settled by negotiation sometime before a trial begins. And what that means is that settlement is the overwhelming norm. You don't go to trial unless somebody in the system, whether it be client or a lawyer, is a little nuts. So you're going to settle your divorce. That's a 99% probability. And the question is how you're going to do it. And the way it's been done historically is that people hire lawyers to fight and to prepare for a trial. And that preparation can go anywhere from 1 to 4 years, depending on the state you're in. And then on the eve of trial, after you have totally alienated each other, spent a ton of money, and become emotionally exhausted, the lawyers negotiate a settlement. So it's a very schizophrenic, wasteful way of arriving at a settlement. And the alternative that's been growing for the past 20 years is mediation, in which a third-party, impartial expert assists the couple in doing their own negotiated settlement, using lawyers as advisors but not as surrogates. So when I say how people go about getting at their settlement, I'm really talking about the alternatives between mediation, which is a facilitated negotiation, versus a litigated settlement, as weird as that may sound.
Yeah,
people who do it with the help of the mediator tend to come out of it with dramatically better results. If by better results you're looking at the extent to which they regard the settlement as fair and the extent to which they're able to cooperate around issues of the kids.
So you're a believer in a good divorce?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think most people are capable of it if they get the right advice soon enough and if they have the presence of mind to resist the siren call of let's go fight.
Yeah. That's hard, though, to get around that because there's so much emotion and one party might be really wronged and they're looking for, maybe one party is looking to punish the other.
Well, that certainly happens in some divorces, but that's sort of the television and movie and soap opera version of divorce. Most divorces really don't involve that. Most divorces are the result of marriages that have sort of quietly drowned rather than exploded.
Mm.
And people are sad, they're depressed, they're distant, they're disappointed with each other, there may be some anger. But usually, if you can keep them out of a polarizing process, there's enough residual goodwill and decency left that you can work with. And while there are people who are very angry that their spouse wants out of the marriage, or the people who feel betrayed by an affair or any of the sort of standard things that people are upset about, those people with enough help can make a choice between acting out their feelings destructively versus pursuing their interests going forward.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most people are not crazy.
Yeah.
And you have a choice. You can act out, and you can pitch a fit, and you can make a lot of noise, and you can seek vindication, which you can't get. Or you can settle down and say, okay, this part of life is over. A future lies before me. How do we use the resources of this family to propel all of us into a decent future? And my own experience is that most couples can do that.
Mm. You note that many couples begin this process of divorce stating they want to come out as friends. Can it be done? Can that be done?
I think it's possible to come out friendly. I think it's possible to come out with a respectful, cordial relationship. Friends is more problematic because it's very difficult to ratchet down what had been the most intimate relationship into something that just becomes a friendship. It's very difficult for people, and I sort of dissuade people from that expectation. If it happens, that's great. But for the most part, what we want is we want you to come out of it not active enemies, and we want you to come out of it wishing each other well and not sabotaging each other.
Mm.
If we can accomplish that, then everybody is ahead of the game.
And so are the children, if there are children.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever data there is still suggests that the best predictor of how kids will adapt is the level of conflict or cooperation that's left between their parents when it's over.
Mm. Mediation, do some states now require it?
Well, yes and no.
Yes and no, okay.
There's been a lot of co-optation of mediation, and what's happened is that a lot of court systems have appended something they call mediation to the end of a litigation process. So the real advent of mediation 20-some-odd years ago, in which a mediator works directly with a couple, was perceived as both radical and revolutionary because it displaced the lawyer from the center of the process. The legal profession has not been pleased with that. And so the courts have something that they call mediation, and it varies from one state to another, but usually it preserves the lawyer's centrality and along the way preserves the lawyer's legal fee.
Mm.
So you have to be careful what it is you're talking about when you talk about mediation.
Yeah. I don't know what the situation is in Illinois, to tell you the truth. And I think that I had a friend in Texas who divorced, and I think I remember her telling me that attorneys practicing family law in Texas are required to be certified mediators.
Yeah, but that, again,
yeah.
Unfortunately, it doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot. Here in North Carolina, for example, lawyers take a five-day seminar, and they observe two mediations, and they become certified mediators, having never mediated a single case. And that's the national model, which is sort of a disgrace. Mm-hmm. So to say someone is required to be a certified mediator doesn't say necessarily that they can do a mediation. It just says they've taken a seminar.
Mm-hmm.
There's just been a lot of attempt to damage control on the part of the legal profession, because to the extent that mediation is done in a genuine way, the legal fees are much, much lower.
Mm-hmm. What is your advice then for a couple seeking a good mediator?
I think they have to do a lot of due diligence. I think they have to identify the mediators in their area. They've got to interview. Well, one is they need to check it out through references. They want someone with a lot of experience, and then they want to talk to a few mediators, even if they have to pay for two or three consults, until they find someone they have confidence in.
Mm.
And the depth of experience on the part of that person is what's critical.
Mm. When you train mediators, how do you go about it?
Well, I have been involved in it primarily through a clinical type of training program, in which after we put people through some kind of initial introduction, we have a clinic, a clinical setting, in which mediators, new mediators, get to mediate either behind a one-way mirror with a supervisor observing, or on closed-circuit TV with, again, a supervisor and other trainees observing. So it's a clinical training model.
Hmm.
And you know, mediation is a craft. I don't think you can learn it other than hands-on.
Yeah. One of the things that made me smile in the book, outside of all the New Yorker cartoons that you've got in here, the advice that you give people who are training to be mediators, you say very succinctly, be boring.
in terms of
you know, bringing down the temperature, right?
Right. It's a strategic approach you take to helping people calm down. And when they're dealing with very dramatic abstractions and accusations, you sort of reframe things so that you're dealing with very practical, concrete issues where it's, you know, where it's difficult to get excited. So if someone accuses his wife of being outrageously extravagant in buying the children's clothes, the mediator's question is, well, what does a pair of sneakers cost? I mean, it's a way of reframing issues so that they're concrete and not exciting. That's where we want the dialogue.
Mm. You say in this book that there are three phases to divorce. What are they?
Well, I guess a middle, a beginning, and an end. But the more clinically, there's the decision to divorce, in which typically one of the parties decides that he or she wants a divorce. And then there's the reaction to that. There is the separation stage and how that's managed. And then there is the negotiation of a settlement. And you have to sort of look at the negotiation of a settlement as the last important task of the marriage itself. This is the last major task these people have to do together.
Mm-hmm.
And so setting that up and making it happen in a reasonable and a fruitful and intelligent way is really the core task of the divorce.
Yeah. You liken that first stage of divorce, the decision, to stepping into a boat and putting the boat into the rapids of a raging river. Is it possible to be prepared for that first stage?
Well, the question is, who's prepared?
Okay, good.
You've got to make a distinction between the psychological state of the person who initiates the divorce, the one who says, I want to end the marriage, and the psychological state of the other partner. Now, in the rare case, maybe 10%, so it's not so rare, where the two of them come to that decision at the same time, where we have a mutual decision, it's relatively easy for both of them to be psychologically ready. In many cases, though, one of them reaches the decision, and the other one is not even close. This person is surprised, is disillusioned, feels betrayed, is very much in disarray. And whether or not that person is given time to come to grips with the thing is really going to shape how the divorce turns out. Because if you rush that person, that's when you end up with the worst kind of litigation. So if you're the initiator of the divorce, having the patience, once you tell your partner that you want a divorce, having the patience to wait while that person works it through a little bit is very, very important. That's one of the things we try and help folks do.
Yeah. Further advice for telling a spouse I'd like a divorce? The setting, the timing?
Well, obviously, it needs to be in a safe place. It needs to be done in very neutral language with no attempt made to justify or condemn or criticize. And it has to be done in the context of, I am sad about this. I don't know any other alternative. This is what I believe we have to do. So it's gentle. It's like telling someone that a loved one has died. How would you do that? What kind of tone would you use? What kind of setting would you choose? And then when the other person reacts, maybe anger or whatever, you have to stay calm. I mean, it's like the opening, it's the opening scene of a play. And it sets the mood and it sets the tone. And if you're calm and you're humane and you hold on to that as you do it, you've got a pretty good shot at it. It's counterintuitive. It's a matter of understanding that what you do by instinct is generally wrong.
Once those words are spoken, I want a divorce, is reconciliation possible?
Unlikely. I mean, it's not that the reconciliation becomes unlikely because someone said, I want a divorce. But in my experience, when one of the partners says, I want a divorce, it means the marriage is, in fact, dead. That person's been thinking about it a very long time. That person has become detached emotionally from the other one. That person already has visions of life improving once he or she gets separated. There's nothing left. So even though the impulse to attempt reconciliation is very commonplace, the likelihood of success is very low because the relationship is dead. You know, it's like trying to wake the dead, literally.
When a couple encounters problems in their marriage, they may seek out counseling to improve the relationship. Can a counselor help a couple break up, help them achieve a good divorce?
Yeah, I think good counselors do it all the time.
Yeah.
There is such a thing as divorce counseling, in which people go for counseling not to save the marriage, but to get a better mutual understanding of why it's ending and to make some general decisions about how to end it. I think good counselors can be very helpful. I think too many counselors are timid in this area, but I think a competent, bold counselor can play a very important role.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the day in the month that we talk about the law, a program we do once a month on the last Friday of the month. Our topic today is divorce, and our guest is attorney and mediator Sam Margulies. He's also the author of two books on divorce, Getting Divorced Without Ruining Your Life, and the latest, his newest, A Man's Guide to a Civilized Divorce, How to Divorce with Grace, A Little Class, and a Lot of Common Sense. The publisher is the Rodale Press. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, also invited about divorce. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-WILL, 800-222-9455. Within these three stages of divorce, what are the most common problems? What are the biggest difficulties couples face in each stage?
Well, I would say for the average middle class couple, there are some major practical issues. Very many middle class Americans live on 105% of their net income. When you go from one household to two households, you generally increase total expenses 30 to 40%. Mm. So you're looking at major deficit problems. And in order to solve those problems, very significant changes have to be made. Sometimes one of the parents who had been staying home has to get a job and resume a career or get a career. Sometimes a house has to be sold because it's too expensive. People have to move. The people have to reduce their budgets and give up certain kinds of amenities. So the economic adjustment and the retrenchment that's required can be very painful. And the danger is one of the people who is very upset about having to do that tries to find refuge in the notion, well, this is your fault. So you're the one who ought to suffer. You're the one who should accept dislocation. But the children and I should be able to maintain the status quo. Mm. And that's a very bad posture to take because that guarantees a struggle that's going to get ugly.
I'm going to interrupt you here because we've got a listener on the toll-free line waiting on a cell phone. So let's go and talk with this listener, and then we can come back and talk about the practical issues of divorce. Caller on line 4, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
You said that only about 1% of these folks end up in litigation, and I tend to agree with you. I'm peripherally involved in a situation where within a marriage, the wife keeps threatening, I want a divorce, and I'm taking the kids. And it's used as a tool, it appears to me, that it's used as a tool to balance power. I don't know, it's kind of like the kids are used as a weapon. And given what you said about one person saying, I want a divorce, I guess this is really confusing because it's, I want a divorce, but there's never a separation or leave-taking. It's like there's a lot of drama in terms of taking the kids and going to mother's for the afternoon, but then everything is like nothing ever happened, despite efforts on the other party's part to talk about it or to discuss it. And it's just really odd to me. Can you comment on this?
I'm not quite sure what the question is.
Well, I guess the question is that you said that typically when somebody says, I want a divorce, and then generally speaking, that process is one of moving on, mm-hmm. of actually making that happen, that they said that because they wanted that to happen. And I'm
I see where you're going. There are people who I think quite foolishly use divorce as a gesture to try to get the other spouse to shape up. And I've seen it backfire on folks. I've seen people threaten divorce who didn't want a divorce, but they were choosing a dramatic way to intimidate the other person into behaving differently. And that's just an unfortunate strategy because it backfires and does too much damage. So it sort of sounds like that's what's going on here.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Well, back to the practical issues. Until the divorce is final, how do you go about negotiating the interim in terms of handling finances?
Well, first of all, understand that the finality of divorce is not the measuring time. The measuring time is when do you conclude your settlement agreement. And it's sort of a misnomer. It's possible to be living according to a settlement agreement, and the divorce is not yet official. So the finality of divorce is not a term that's useful. The question is, how do people manage economics while they're trying to work out the settlement? And it's certainly a very important role for a mediator to help people work out something temporary. And usually what you're trying to do is maintain the status quo as much as you can. And sometimes we work out some interim financing in order to allow one of the parties to move out. And then look at a longer-term picture to figure out how you allocate income between two households. Mm-hmm. It's a very practical, budget-driven, negotiated process. And it's probably where most of the action is. I mean, there's more work generally for people to work out the money than there is for people to work out issues of kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to come to the kids issue here very shortly, but I want to take some other phone calls. Let's talk with a listener, another listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi. I do agree. Kids are definitely a major issue. I've been divorced for about 13 years now, and just recently I had a pretty nasty situation that I guess I wanted to ask about. I have a 14-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old daughter, and they're from my first marriage, and I have a 2.5-year-old son. And during one of my visits with my 14-year-old daughter, my 16-year-old didn't come over that weekend. She helped us with a garage sale, and then she, I guess we discovered that she had stolen some of the money during the garage sale. And a week had passed, and they both the girls came over on that next week, and they were supposed to spend a week's vacation with us. And it turned out kind of bad because we had her on Friday, and Friday evening we confronted the 14-year-old with the the issue of the stealing, and we asked her, of course, to come up with some ideas for working on trust issues and stuff, and just basically trying to find a way to work out the situation. And she got angry and mad and just made it, very, very apparent that she wasn't, willing to do any work on it. So Saturday came about, and she got more and more resolute and angry and said that, when we turned our back, she was going to walk out and leave. And in a panic, I finally decided that I needed to call her mom, and I guess legally what I'm trying to find out is do I need to notify the other parent of stuff like this? Because basically what happened was the other parent got very she basically didn't think we were parenting correctly, we didn't need to do what we were doing, whatever. And, you know, we were just trying to set down boundaries and guidelines, and she finally decided that she was just going to come and get her daughters, and that's all there was to it, and it got ugly, and I set down some boundaries, you know, about her being able to come back, and it just, it felt like something that escalated, probably because of my phone call to her and having to, I guess my personal feeling that I had to involve her. I guess I need to know how much personal involvement at this age, at this length of our, you know, working through our divorce and everything, that I need to be, even allowing her to have any input. So I guess I'd better shut up and let you talk. So.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Suppose it was reversed.
Sure.
Suppose that your 14-year-old daughter stole something in her mother's house.
Yes.
And that precipitated some kind of a crisis around issues of character.
Yes.
Would you want to be involved?
I'd like to be involved. I would not
like... Would you like to be consulted?
I would like... I would like to be consulted, but I think that as long as I saw it as being reasonable parenting, you know, and using reasonable parenting skills, that I would then allow my ex-wife, the spouse, ex-spouse, to use her good judgment and deal with the situation.
Okay, but there are three separate issues. So the first issue is that you and your ex need to figure out how to get on the same page with respect to the management of a couple of adolescent kids who have some of the normal issues of growth and conflict and character development and so on.
Right.
My suspicion is that the problem arises when you involve your second wife in issues of disciplining your daughter. And I think when you do that, you set yourself up for exactly what happened.
And I suppose that's possibly true, but...
I also think it's unfair to your present wife because it puts her in a no-win situation.
So you,
being the stepmother of an adolescent girl is a minor nightmare under the best of conditions. And to set her up to participate in a disciplinary process,
I see,
really sets up what happened. And so my suggestion is that you consider several things. One, an agreement that she's permitted to not be involved in that part of things.
My second wife.
Yes. And two, that you propose to your first wife that the two of you do a little work with a family therapist to try and figure out some mutually acceptable protocols for managing issues with your kids. But you got to get your wife out of it.
Right. And there are a lot of extenuating circumstances, and I have tried a lot to get my ex-wife to work through therapy.
Yeah, but you got to get your present wife out of it. That's going to be the key.
I guess legally maybe that's
legal is not going to solve your problems. Forget legal.
Well, you know, we've got counselors that tell us, you know, opposing viewpoints. So that's why it's difficult to assess, you know. That's why I'm calling you, is to see.
Yeah, but you're not going to solve it in a courtroom. So there's the remedy for you is not legal. It is strategic.
I agree with you on that, except that, you know, I have a wonderful second wife who parents wonderfully. We've taken parenting classes. We do wonderful things. And we've got a 2.5-year-old son that has to be in the middle of a lot of the stuff that goes on, and a lot of the difficulty that goes on with the acting out of my teenage daughters. So then I feel like I'm torn between two families that I have to respect, and it's difficult.
Tension with stepchildren.
I'm sorry.
It's probably the
tension between step-parents and step-children is probably the leading cause of the failure of second marriages.
The sad part of it is that we've never had any tension, literally, between the daughters and my wife, my second wife. We have had tensions between my ex-wife and my second wife, and tensions between me and my ex-wife. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having said all that, you know, I talked to my ex-wife's husband, trying to reach her to let her know about this particular situation. His thoughts were that we were doing the correct thing, that actually him and I were in agreement, but he believed that he still needed to go by what his wife said, which I understood that, respect, you know, that he needed to go by what his wife said, my ex-wife. Right. But when dealing with her, she just...
I think you ought to propose that you and your ex-wife go to a mediator and deal with the issue. You need the help of a third party, and it's got to be between the two of you. It's the biological parents that have to resolve these issues.
Mm. I think that's good advice, and I wish our listener well, and I'm going to go on to another caller now. Listener in Urbana on line 2. Good afternoon.
Well, good afternoon. Now we're talking American talk radio, Celeste. Advice to the lovelorn at long last. I went through a divorce 20 years ago, and it was a wonderful divorce. We had the same attorney. There was no warfare. And my ex and I are good buddies today, but I have a couple of friends that are divorced, but the warfare just goes on. I've already lost the husband as a friend, and I think I'm about ready to lose the wife. And the attorneys, the legal profession, is just ripping them apart. They're keeping the warfare going, and I mean, they're just absolute vultures. And if you could give us some advice on how to deal with the legal profession here, I'd be much obliged. I'll hang up and listen and won't rejoin you. Thank you.
Okay, managing the lawyers.
Well, I think I think half the battle is how you choose a lawyer. And again, the popular myth is the one that's wrong, which is you go out and you look for the most aggressive lawyer. And in every town and in every jurisdiction, there are a couple of lawyers who have a reputation as the fighters and the ones who never give up and never surrender and fight to the last dollar. Those are the lawyers who need to be avoided like a plague. And when you have people, I mean, in the town where I practice, there are certain lawyers where I would predict that when the two of them get in the same case, one is the legal fees are going to be six figures, and two, when the divorce is over, the couple will be unable to speak to each other. And that's not a function of the couple. It's a function of the personality of these lawyers. Now, there are also lawyers out there who are decent, and there are lawyers out there who are not looking to drag cases out and are not looking to have a scorched earth war in every battle. And it's your job, if you're hiring a lawyer, to search them out. That's really half the issue. The other half is people need to mediate rather than litigate. And so they need to generally limit the role that the lawyers play. So if one keeps those two things in mind, and when you have friends who are going to get a divorce, instead of counseling them to go find the toughest lawyer they can, you counsel them to go find the gentlest, competent lawyer they can. Big difference.
Stay out of the junkyard and avoid that dog.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line 3. Hi.
Hey, everybody. I'm divorced, too. I had a very amicable divorce, and we focused just about everything on the two kids, and it kind of steered us in the right direction. But many of my friends, the guy friends I have, they seem to be paying just outrageous prices on a weekly basis for child support. And I was wondering if there's ever going to be a change in the law in which after you get a divorce and you're a father and you're living on $12.50 a week, that doesn't sound like that's justice to me. And have you heard of any changes in which rearing the children financially is just as much the responsibility of the female as it is the guy? And the second question is, what's all this I hear about if you vacate the primary residency, you're sunk? The party that leaves the primary residency or the family home has sent a message to the court that they're washing their hands of the whole business, and that's kind of a negative thing.
I think that's totally... Yeah, okay, let me deal with your second question first. I think it's complete myth. And, in fact, I encourage people to separate early, and I encourage, if it's going to be the wife who's going to be a primary parent and the husband who's eventually going to leave, I encourage him to leave sooner rather than later. Because for people to live in the same home with a dead marriage does tremendous psychological damage to everyone in the family. Again, it's one of the myths that's promoted by a lot of dumb lawyers. It is not true. When you leave the house, you're not forfeiting any property rights. And you're not sending any messages to the court, because in 99% of the cases, the court's not going to make any decisions anyhow. So it's all myth, virtually all of it. The other thing, you know, the other issue of men sort of being taken to the cleaners on child support is also an area where I don't agree with you. In the past 15 years, in response to federal requirements, virtually all states have established minimum child support guidelines, which most lawyers sort of adhere to. My experience with those guidelines is that they're generally too low and that they're inadequate to meet the real needs of raising children. So my experience with like 3,000 divorces is not the same as your experience. I don't find men universally paying unreasonable and outrageous amounts of child support. I think there are some cases in which the combination of alimony and child support can feel very oppressive to men. But I don't share the view that men as a sex are the victimized group in the divorce world.
Hmm. We have to wrap up very quickly here. Before we go, maybe you would offer us some thoughts on the couples you've worked with who have children and have achieved a good divorce. How do they handle the issues of child custody? Often that custody battle is seen as a battle, a win-lose struggle.
Well, again, there's been an exaggeration of the number of custody fights that there are. Custody fights are still pretty rare. 70% of American mothers are employed. And when you have a two-career family, two-job family, the objective fact is that the parents need each other, and they need the cooperation of the other, and each needs major involvement on the part of the other parent. So I think the majority of parents, certainly the ones that I work with, start out with a premise that they need each other's involvement. And in fact, the primary time that you get off from your children, which people need, is going to be the time when the children are with the other parent. And so the custody fight is more an indicator of a lot of pathology on the part of the parents than it is typical.
Hmm. And that goes to one of the themes of your book, A Man's Guide to Civilized Divorce. You got to act like a grown-up.
You bet.
Yeah. Well, that's where we'll leave it. Sam Margolies, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Our guest this afternoon, attorney and mediator Sam Margolies. He is the author of two books on divorce, Getting Divorced Without Ruining Your Life, his latest, A Man's Guide to a Civilized Divorce, How to Divorce with Grace, a Little Class, and a Lot of Common Sense. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, we should have settlement prices now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, another tough day in the bean pit. The August contract off 25 cents. The deferred's not nearly as low, but they were still off 15.5. We'll get a complete look at those numbers in just a bit. And we'll talk with this afternoon with the folks up at Risk Management Commodities in Chalmers, Indiana, about why that happened today and what the continuation of rainfall in the Midwest and good crop conditions will mean right into the fall and maybe past that. Let's start with the wheat pit for the settlement prices, the highs and the lows. September contract at a high this week of 315.5, today of 315.5. A low at 310, a settlement price there at 312.25. They were 0.5 cent lower on the day. December futures, 329, the high, the low at 323.5. December wheat settling the day at 325.5, down 0.75 cents. March futures, 340, the high, the low at 335.5, settled 337. They were off 0.5 cent. The May contract, 2.5 lower, had a high today of 340, a low at 344, and a low at 340, settled 340.5, down 2.5. July wheat, 349.5, the high, the low at 347.5, settlement price there at 348, and that July next year, harvest month, down 0.75 cents at the end of the day on this Friday afternoon. September corn, 221.5, the high, the low at 216.5, settlement price 217.25, off 0.25 cents, fairly good settlement price there, given the 25-cent drop in the beans for the August contract. December corn now, 230.5, the high, the low at 225, settled 225.5. They were 1.5 cents lower. And the March contract, 239 high, low at 234, a settlement at 234.25. They were 1.25 cents lower on the day. May corn, 245 high, low at 240.25, settled on that low, down 1.75 cents. And July futures were 1.5 cents lower today. Had a high of 249.5, a low at 245, settled 0.25 cents above that at 245.25, 1.5 cents lower. December next year, 2005 corn, the only gainer in the pit for the day. 255 the high, the low at 253.25, settled 254.5. They were up 0.75 cents. September oats now, 125.25 high, low at 120.5, settlement price at 121.75, 2.25 lower. And the December, 131.75 high, low at 128.25, settled 129.75, and they were down 2.25 on the day. For the soy complex, the nearby August beans off 25 cents today. Their high 633, low at 599, and a settlement price at 599.5. They were down 25 cents. Of course, it was first notice day for August beans. We'll talk to the folks in Chalmers, Indiana about that, too. 590 the high today in the September's, low at 574. Settlement price at 574.5. They were 15.5 lower. November beans, 582.5 high, low at 568. Settled 569. The settlement price there down 15.75. January soybeans now, 589 the high, the low at 576, settled 577. They were down 15.25, and the March futures were off 15 cents, 596 the high, the low at 584. March soybeans settled 585.5. November futures for next year, 595 the high, the low at 587, settled 588, down 9.25 on the day. August bean meal, 204 the high, the low at 192, settled 198. Off 210, and the September bean meal, 193.50 high, low at 185, a settlement price at 187. They were off 520. August bean oil, 22.98 the high, the low at 21.82, settled 22, even, down 83. And the September bean oil, 22.55 the high, low at 21.48, settlement price there at 21.65, and they finished the day 89 lower. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Livestock prices were also lower today, Todd. Let's take a look at what happened. August feeder cattle, the high today was 115.10, the low 113.90, the settlement 114.65, that down 82.5. September 113.55, the high 112.30, the low 112.97.5, the settlement, that down 92.5. October feeder cattle, 112.70 the high, 111 even the low, the settlement 112.10, that down 97.5. August live cattle, the high today 86.25, the low 85.27.5, the settlement 85.72.5, that down 115. September 88.50 the high, 87.50 the low, 88.50 the settlement, that down $2. October live cattle, 88.80 the high, 87.90 the low, 88.75 the settlement, that down 70. August lean hog, 78.30 the high, 77.10 the low, 77.75 the settlement, that down 42.5. October, 69.90 the high, 68.70 the low, 69.22.5 the settlement, that down 62.5. December lean hog, 64.95 the high, 63.70 the low, 64.75 the settlement, that down 12.5. And February, 62.45 the high, 61.05 the low, 62.42.5 the settlement, that finishing on the plus side up 12.5. August bellies, 105.15 the high, 102.55 the low, 104.10 the settlement, that down 95. The Dow is down 35 points at 10,094. The NASDAQ is 5 higher at 1886. The S&P 500 down 2 at 1098.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Danny Grimmer from Green Bay, Wisconsin writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I drank coffee for 25 years. In the last 6 months, a cup of coffee in the morning would put me right back to sleep. My eyelids would suddenly get heavy, my temples tight, and my face felt like a concrete mask. So I quit drinking coffee. What happened? Did caffeine turn on me?"
When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I drank as a child, I slept as a child. But now I am an adult, and I have put away childish things. It's time you graduated to the real world of coffee drinking. I bet you've been drinking wimp coffee and expecting the results you can only get from a stiffly brewed pot of Ethiopian har-rar-rar-rar-rar. That concrete mask is what non-coffee drinkers feel all the time. We who've become used to the invigorating effects of Java forget what it was like to sleepwalk through life, operating at a fraction of our true potential. Don't worry. Grind some real beans. The best years are still ahead of you.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath. To order the Dr. Science Smug Mug, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. 60-